Welcome. Hey, welcome to ARC Talk. This is your host, Ron Jacobs, and I am so delighted that you're with me today. Because today we're going to be talking about, you know, just one of those crazy things that you hear about and you're not sure if it's something you need to tune into. I don't know if you're like me, but, you know, around Microsoft, we hear about a lot of stuff that's happening, stuff that's coming. And sometimes you're like, well, I just can't listen to everything. So you turn off some things. And maybe you've heard about people talking about DSLs, and we're not talking about the communications technology, but rather we're talking about domain-specific languages, or maybe you've heard them talk about software factories, and this kind of stuff. Well, if you thought this is something you didn't need to know about, you were wrong, my friend. You are so wrong. And today on the podcast, we are joined by Steve Cook, who is just a great guy. He called me from the UK, and I just hooked up the phone to the recording stuff so we could hear from him. And he's got some great thoughts on what this is all about. I think you're going to enjoy listening to Steve and learning how this could apply to you. And to tell you the truth, I'm now going to have to spend some time trying to create my own DSL thing. In the past, I thought, no, that's for somebody else to do. But now I'm thinking, really, there's probably a good reason to do it. So you tell me what you think, right? Tune in, listen up. We're going to have some links for you at the end of the broadcast, and you can go to these links and discuss what you think. We'll have a wiki page where we can write up some thoughts about DSLs and software factories. Anyway, it's cool stuff. Listen up, Steve Cook. Today, I am joined by Steve Cook, who is a software architect in our enterprise tools group. And actually, Steve, you're based out of the UK, aren't you?
That's right.
And that must be challenging for you to work with us, with the Redmond guys, and being based out of the UK.
Well, you know, there's an 8-hour time shift, and that often means I work quite late at night, but on the other end, I get in quite late in the morning, so that's fine. And I get a lot of quiet time during the day.
Okay. All right. Well, today, Steve, we are going to talk about model-driven architecture and a little bit about what this is all about and what Microsoft is doing in this area. And so I think it's kind of an area that really I don't know a lot about, but I was looking over the OMG's page on model-driven architecture, and it seemed to me that they were sort of saying a story that we've heard before, which is essentially that if you could describe your application in terms of diagrams and stuff, that there would be tools that would convert it into any given platform that you might want. And so, like in their little diagram, they're saying, you know, as long as you could describe your thing with UML and MOF and CWM, that they could then take tools that might translate it into a Java app, a .NET app, a Corba app, or whatever. So, what do you think about that kind of vision?
Well, MDA, model-driven architecture, which is a trademark of the OMG, actually means quite a lot of different things to different people, I think. And I was very much involved in the OMG before I joined Microsoft. I represented IBM on the standardization of UML2, for example. So here's a few things that I think model-driven architecture means to different people. First off, I think kind of out there in general, to people who don't know much about it, it just means model-driven development in general. It means, oh, we'll create some models and we'll generate some code from it, kind of thing. Then, kind of more specifically, from the OMG's point of view, it means doing that using the OMG's technology. And even that means different things to different people, because to some people, they talk about what they call platform-independent models and platform-specific models and transformations between these models. So, as you said, it's proposed that you can build a model that's platform-independent and somehow transform it into like a Java application or a .NET application. Some other people think of it as UML is a programming language. And there are a couple of books out there really proposing that you think of UML as a programming language. And then I think some other people say, well, it's not really about UML, it's about using OMG technologies to do model development. So it's kind of hard to pin down what MDA really means. But I think you're right in categorizing it as being, if you like, a return to the case vision of we'll take models and we'll generate applications from them. And I think if you're going to take that seriously, you have to really question why case didn't turn out to be terribly successful. Because I don't think, you know, having said what we've said, that we've really said anything that would make it any more successful this time around. So I think that there are really important missing factors in, you know, the formulation of model-driven architecture that's on there on the IMG website or that we've discussed so far, which will make it work. And one of them is you don't start with a model. If you take as your starting point, oh, we're going to have a model and we're going to generate things from it, that's really the wrong place to start. What you've got to start from is what you're going to generate. And that's absolutely critical thing to understand if you're going to make any success of generating code from models. And that's what we call domain-specific development, which is a kind of different thing from MDA.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then about that. So you said if the starting point is not the model, but the thing you're going to generate is like the application, I guess, is what you're saying?
Well, parts of the application, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because, well, it seemed to me that one of the weaknesses of this model, at least I found sort of frustrating in doing UML stuff, is that it tries to be so all-encompassing and general purpose that it, maybe domain-specific would allow you to be, well, to be more specific to the kind of problem that you're trying to solve. Is that what you're getting at, that this is the big advantage we're pursuing?
Yes, yes. There's a kind of basic pattern here, which is what I think of as being the language-driven programming pattern. And this, again, has been around for a while, but really, if you have a framework, a bunch of code in a framework, then there's a particular kind of code you write to use that framework, which I think of as being configuration code. And it's the code that takes the framework and instantiates it to your particular case. You know, you create instances of this and instances of that and wire them up, and that's the solution to your problem. And you'll see a lot of that kind of thing. For example, you see that if you're creating GUIs, right? You create controls and forms and stuff, and you wire them together through configuration code. And you get a similar pattern applying in many domains. And I think that's the kind of code that you can target your generation at. That's the kind of code that you want your models to transform into. So there's a really intimate relationship between the models and the framework, which is the models are essentially creating configuration code for the framework. And if you take that perspective, then what you want to do is design a modeling environment specifically for that job, right? Specifically for generating for that particular framework. Now, if your starting point is UML, which, as you say, is very kind of ambitious and trying to talk about lots and lots of things, and if I may say so as an author of it, is very kind of up and down and patchy in the level of abstraction at which it talks about things, then if you're trying to address any particular configuration problem with it, then you'll find it doesn't fit. Right? It doesn't fit. You're going to have to somehow bend it to make it fit. So you're going to have to extra labels and stereotypes and tagging things to the UML and build special generators that understand those labels and tags and things and end up with something which fits together with your framework. But, you know, that can be a big job. It's not for the faint-hearted. The UML spec in itself is, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages long. Isn't it easier just to take the job of generating this special configuration code and design the language directly to do it? And that's the view that we take. It is easier to do that.
You know, so I can completely understand what you're saying, because it seemed to me that when I first learned UML about 95, that it worked really well for describing the object interactions, like within, you know, a business logic layer. And, you know, I could really use it very well for that sort of thing. But as I tried to use it to describe more complex distributed applications or, you know, even things like web services later on when they came around, it seemed harder to get important elements of the model into UML because it didn't really have a construct for describing the element of the model that you wanted. So you were always ended up, you know, kind of fudging the model in some way to make it work. So I can completely get that. And I think, like you said, this understanding the framework you're targeting, it's almost like you would develop a very different kind of modeling language to describe a GUI-based app versus maybe a collection of web services that are going to do something and have nothing to do whatsoever with UI. So the models might be entirely different for the way that you describe the thing you're intending to build.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, UML was designed in the 1990s. The kind of prevailing methodology was OOA and D, right? Object-oriented analysis and design, where there was a theory going around at that time that you could do an object-oriented analysis. You'd kind of analyze the objects in your business domain, and then you'd build kind of sequence diagrams to work out how these objects talk to each other to get your, if you like, a sketch of the behavior of your software at the kind of high level where you haven't tried to map it down to any particular technology. And then the thought back then was that you could kind of add detail to that model and turn it into a design and actually eventually turn it into the code. Now these days, you know, that just won't work, right? You can't add detail to turn an object-oriented analysis model into a bunch of cooperating web services on distributed servers with, you know, load balancing going on in between them and all manner of interesting stuff, right? It just doesn't work like that. We live in a different world these days. So, I mean, basically, I think a lot of people think of UML in that way that you describe, which is you've got class diagrams, you've got sequence diagrams, you've got use case diagrams, maybe you've got state diagrams, maybe you've got activity diagrams, but really those three, right? Classes, use cases, and sequence diagrams. And you do a kind of high-level object-oriented analysis as a documentation, as an understanding of your problem. And then by and large, you throw it away, right? You've used it to understand your problem. You then got to move on to mapping it to today's technology. Now, I mean, if you look at some of the tools we've just put out in Visual Studio 2005, like the Application Designer, that's a modeling tool for designing applications that talk to each other, right? And it has rectangles with ports on the edge and lines. Those ports on the edge of the rectangles represent endpoints, and the lines represent communications, and the boxes represent applications. Well, there is something in UML a bit like that. But the thing about our modeling tool is that the model is basically directly connected to the framework, in our case, in that particular tool, ASP.NET, that implements this stuff. And so there is no big conceptual leap between the model and the framework. It's just direct. It's a direct mapping. And I think there's another important distinction to make about UML, apart from that it's really an object-oriented analysis and design language, if you like, and it should be kept as that. I mean, it doesn't work very well to be other things. The other distinction to be made is that most people understand it through its notation. It's extremely popular as a notation. It's not popular as a meta-model. Very few people understand it as a meta-model. And if you want to use it for model-driven development, you have to understand it as a meta-model. And then you really get into some kind of deep stuff, you know, where I think it's just not a very efficient place to be today. You can make it work, but like you said, you know, it really doesn't fit very well. So we think you should take the notation as a brilliant inspiration, right? Where people expect to see UML notational conventions like the way it organizes, you know, the direction of inheritance arrows or the places that black diamonds appear, or all those things that people kind of understand. Let's reuse all of that. Let's not reinvent any of that. But where it's really not the right tool for the job, let's not try and use it.
So, you know, the interesting thing about what we've done, I think, in what you guys have done, because I didn't have anything to do with it, but in VS 2005, is rather than just building a better modeling language, we actually built a platform for domain-specific languages with the idea that anybody ought to be able to build one of these.
Yes. Let's make it easy to build a language. I mean, we talk about language-driven development or domain-specific development, and the basic pattern is that you start by identifying in your domain or your framework or your problem or whatever you want to call it, some holes that you can fill by defining models, which in the case of distributed applications could well be the holes you could fill, could be the configuration of the applications and the way that they talk to each other, right? Or in the case of a real-time system, the hole you might fill would be the state machine that runs that thing. Or there's lots of examples, right? Mm-hmm. So you start by identifying the hole that you want to fill, and you design the language to fill that hole, and we've got a framework that will implement modeling languages. So basically, also we bootstrap it, right? So we have a language for defining languages, and we have a framework for defining languages. And the hole that you fill in that framework is the design of the language as a model. So we have a model for creating languages, which includes creating the conceptual model for the language, the notation for the language, the serialization format for the language, the way the validation is done for the language, the way the code generation is done from the language. So you can kind of define all that quite quickly and compile it and run it. And there's your language. It's implemented as a tool in Visual Studio, and it will fill the hole in your framework. So we're putting a lot of effort into making it very easy to define these languages, and that's what we call the DSL tools.
So, you know, let me think through an example of this with you. For example, the group that I used to be with, the Patterns and Practices team, has built a UI framework. They called it the Composite UI Application Block, which is a framework for building UIs and using a composite pattern with smart client applications. And like you said, this framework, when you're targeting an application at this framework, there's a certain set of things you got to do, which is like building up the configuration that the framework is going to apply at runtime. So you got to describe the composite pieces, these things we call smart parts, and the workspaces that they're going to work together and how they relate together. And you describe this partly in configuration, but partly in code. And so right now, though, it requires a developer to just kind of know what this configuration stuff has to be like through a lot of experience, and then they can sit down and apply it. But if they were to take this extra step, they could build a DSL language with shapes and stuff like that, and a design surface that you could drag these things around and connect them up graphically, and then generate the working config code that would make the thing functional. It would probably still need code, but you would maybe handle, I don't know, 60, 70% of the stuff that needs to configure the app. Is that a good analogy?
That's exactly right, yes. We haven't done that with the composite block that you're talking about, but we certainly could. We actually did a version of that with an earlier PAG block, which was the UIP block, right? Interface Process block. We built a little demo language, which is essentially a flowchart. And from that flowchart, you would generate several things. You generate the app.config file, which contains the essential kind of logic of how you flow through the thing, and you generate some default pages, which would then, you know, customize yourself in code, and generate some other stuff. I mean, we used templates to generate these classes and config files to complete the UIP block. Absolutely, you could do the same with the smart client one, I'm sure.
Okay, so to be practical, I know a lot of the enterprises I talk to, they have, you know, especially in larger ones, they'll have a team of people that are like their .NET center of excellence or something like that, right? And the idea is that this team of people would evaluate what kind of frameworks and libraries and things we're going to use in our enterprise and develop best practices and training and whatnot, so that the goal being that the business units who are building applications would build them with consistent frameworks and that sort of thing. They would achieve more reuse and better productivity. Is it out of the realm of reality for a team like that to build a DSL? So maybe, like, you know, you're working at some really big bank and you've got your own kind of in-house frameworks that you've developed for building stuff. Would it be impractical to say, hey, you at that bank, you could build your own language, your own DSL language to assist your business units when they go to build the apps with that thing?
We've got several customers doing exactly that with early versions of the DSL tools, or at least evaluating them to do exactly that job, exactly that.
Okay.
Absolutely. That's a key scenario for us.
Well, so that it sounds like that's where, you know, this thing could really take off, because, you know, a lot of people thought, oh, well, yeah, maybe ISVs will go out and build these, but your average guy can't hope to figure that out. But it sounds like it's not that hard.
I think ISVs is, the thing about ISVs is they tend to probably want to start at a bit lower level. They may well want to use our modeling platform, but they don't really want to build a DSL in a day or even a week. They want to do something which for them is a product which has a lot of added value, right? So they're going to be operating at a more detailed level of customization. What we're really talking about is groups just like the one you mentioned, or SIs, right? People who are running consultancies who want to be able to reuse their own domain knowledge over a bunch of their customers. So they might walk in with their own frameworks or their own DSLs and be able to solve particular classes of problems in vertical industries quickly, because they have captured domain knowledge in their own language. So the people who are showing the most interest in what we're doing today are central architecture groups in large enterprises and SIs.
Now, I could imagine, though, like in the late 90s, I used to work for ERP type ISVs. And I can imagine those guys thinking of their ERP platform as really a highly customizable framework, because essentially that's what we tried to build, because every customer had a different thing. And, you know, the way we would do it is when the customer purchased this stuff, we'd send an army of consultants in there who would know how to customize our stuff to make it work for them. But I could imagine that this would be a very powerful paradigm for even an ISV in that kind of model, in that you think of the components of your enterprise software as a set of building blocks that will need to be assembled, and giving them a DSL to assemble them would really be a helpful thing.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I'm not saying that they wouldn't be interested, but all I'm really saying is they probably got more funds to invest in that. So they might want to go into the platform a little deeper. But absolutely, we're talking to ISVs about several, actually, about the DSL tools as well, for exactly that reason.
Okay. So,
I think another class of customers for us is actually individuals, right? It's so easy to build a language that you can just kind of do it. It maybe take you a morning. And if you've got a class of problems to solve and you're an individual developer, it's worth doing that.
Okay, so if somebody was interested in picking this up and doing it, I know I hate getting links over audio, but maybe what you could do, Steve, is email me some links and I'll post them up with this recording on the same page. And so people can go and they can download the DSL toolkit and kind of play around with it. And we have some resources to help them.
Absolutely. Well, there's one link, which is a kind of top-level link for what we call a workshop on the Visual Studio site, and it's got links to our tools. It's also got some links to information about about GATT and other stuff about white papers and software factories and all sorts of stuff. So I'll send you that link. That's the best starting point.
Okay, great. Well, this has been really cool. I'm finally, you know, kind of getting the picture. Thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, you're extremely welcome.
Yeah, I told you, didn't I? Just tell me. Yes, say it. Say it out loud. Say, you were right, Ron. This DSL thing is very, very cool. I'm just totally blown away that I've been around here and I didn't get this. But, you know, hey, that's the way it is. There's so much stuff. You have to tune out some things because you can't possibly keep up with it all. But now you're going to want to pay attention to this because Software Factories is way cool. Hey, so I haven't had a chance yet to work up a cool new web address for my new home here on the Architecture Strategy team. Maybe I'll get something like channel9.msdn.com /arctalk. I'm going to ask for that. But until then, you'll just have to go to the links that are here on the podcast page and look for the Architecture Wiki on Channel 9. And yes, it's an ugly thing to read a URL, but this is it. Okay, ready? Here we go. channel9.msdn.com /wiki/default.aspx/channel9.architecture. Okay, go there. That's my little corner of Channel 9. And we have wikis where we're going to just build up knowledge and share with each other because you'll feel so much better when you do. And we'll see you next time on ARC Talk.